Each weekday, a member of the community is invited to Coffee at KYUK to discuss news and information relevant to Bethel and the Kuskokwim Delta. Sometimes light, sometimes serious, Coffee at KYUK is where our community connects.
Well, even when we disagree, one thing that Petra Harpik and myself, Grady Deaton, agree on is we have fun with this show. I was just watching Petra mouth the words to our intro, and it's such it was a good time. We're gonna talk to Dan Gillikin, who's the environmental director for Native Village of Napaimute, and we're also gonna sit down with Mary Peltola here in the studio today. Good morning, Mary. You're with me.
Good morning, Grady. Good morning, Dan Gillikin.
Dan, are you on?
Yeah, sure am. Good morning, everybody.
Dan, you're the environmental director for Napaimute, but you also were previously the director for the Kuskokwim Native Association, fisheries director, rather, for the Kuskokwim Native Association, and the fish biologist for the Yukon Delta NWR. Were you instrumental in getting that those fish wheels that we reported on Friday more prevalent along the Delta?
Yeah, I got actually the original grant for that went to the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission when I was working for KNA, and then I transitioned to Napaimute, and they continued honoring that grant, that proposal, and this was the result of disaster relief funding that came from the 2012-2013 fishery, and we thought it'd be a good way to help people reconnect with that as a technique and hopefully help them meet some of their subsistence needs in a sustainable way.
You know, Petra and I got together before the show and we had a plan and I immediately broke it. She was gonna ask you about and introduce you, but I took the microphone from her. So I'm gonna pitch it off to Petra to take my space there.
Hi, Dan. What is a fish counting weir, and can you describe it for us?
Okay, yeah, the best way to think about a monitoring weir, is that it's a picket fence that is put perpendicular to the current in the river, and it has a spacing between the pickets, which are actually PVC pipes, of about 4 inches, 4 to 5 inches, and then those fences, what they do is they direct fish along the fence into a chute and then into a trap. And on top of that trap, there's a platform where a technician will sit, and they will count fish as they pass through the weir. Now, these traps can either be opened so that fish are just passing through, or they can be closed so that they can actually hold fish in the trap for a period of time, maybe take samples from them, and then release them.
All right. I'm just curious. I'm skipping around a bit, but I'm interested in knowing about how much harm or not harm is done to the fish, and also where are these weirs located? Because I understand they're located near spawning, not other places. So please educate me on that.
Yeah, so currently this year we have, I believe, funding for 6 weirs on the entire Kuskokwim drainage. And they're located on the Kuitluk, the Tuluk Sack, up here on the Aniak, a tributary of the Aniak River, the Salmon River, the George River, the Kugluk, and then the Salmon River up off the Pitka Fork. I believe that's all of them. They're spread out kind of strategically so that we can get counts from, like you mentioned, spawning locations, predominantly spawning locations for Chinook, Coho, and chum salmon. It's kind of interesting to note, we're really only monitoring with these weirs probably something like about 5% of the total spawning area for the whole Kuskokwim, so it's certainly not 100% coverage.
Dan, now the fun begins. What year did commercial fishing on the Kuskokwim River become popular? A, 1940s, B, 1950s, C, 1980s, or D, none of the above?
Interesting question, the way it's framed. You know, I'm going to go with none of the above because if you look at kind of some of the history of commercial fishing on the Kuskokwim, it was never really that popular. It certainly occurred, but even dating as far back as the 1835, they were closing the river to commercial fishing at the request of subsistence users and managers at that time. So the Kuskokwim, although there has been a lot of commercial or some commercial fisheries for Chinook salmon, that probably started, well, it started back as far as the 20s, 1920s, and actually kind of exploded a little bit more in the 70s. But it's never really been what I would say popular with most of the people. It's been predominantly a subsistence system.
Well, my answer is B, 1950s, and I got my answer from Alaska.gov, ADFNG.
Petra, was the question about the Kuskokwim specifically?
Yes, the Kuskokwim River.
Hey, back to weirs for a second. Dan, what is important? Why is it important to collect this escapement information, and how does that information affect subsistence users?
That it's important that we kind of have an idea of the health, I will say, of the system overall for the fisheries. The kind of information that we collect is not just the numbers of fish, but it's also information about the sex ratios of the fish, the ages of the fish, genetics of the fish, the general health of the fish. So all those things combined tell us what the health of the stocks are that are returning. Using that information, we can also then do analysis that allows us to look at the productivity of the systems. How many seeds are we planting, and what kind of returns are we getting from that number of seeds? And that changes through time. And that's important for management to know that, so that we can forecast what future returns are going to be. We can look at trends to see if we're in a declining situation or if abundance is increasing. So all those factors contribute to the information base that managers use for setting up strategies in any particular year.
So I'm looking over the who, what, when, where, and why information that you helped us with for prep, and I'm on the where. Why so few wheres? If the information is so important, why not so many of them?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that, Grady?
Why so few? If the information is so important, why so few weirs?
Yeah, well, A, they're really expensive to operate, and not all sites are really suitable for locating a weir. We go to great lengths to try to find the right kind of location for a weir where you can keep it in place. Many of these systems are just simply too large to install these types of weirs in. And so you have to have the right size of system. You have to locate it in the correct location. They're expensive. And, you know, using modeling techniques, you don't necessarily need to count every last fish. You can estimate with using other data such as radio telemetry work and things like that. You can estimate what escapements could be to these other systems based on the information that you collect at these other spots where the weirs are.
Dan, do you have a quiz for Grady and I?
Sure. Let's go to the first one, because I think this one's interesting. Who established the first weir on the Kuskokwim? Is it A, Department of Fish and Game, B, gold miners around the 1900s, or C, Indigenous people, Alaska Natives?
I'm gonna go with C. That's my vote.
I'm going with B. Gold miners around the 1900s.
Actually, according to reports and some archaeological work that's done up above McGrath on around the Pitka Fork, and Ray Collins loves telling this story, there was a weir that was put in place by local folks up there that operated for, you know, centuries, actually. And it's a pretty common technique throughout Alaska, southeast Alaska. Weirs were operated by the natives. I know in Yakutat where I used to work, all over the place, and it's actually pretty interesting. They use the weirs in the same way that we do now for monitoring fisheries. They would, you know, harvest fish from the weirs, but then they would open them up and allow fish to escape, and they would send people up to make sure that there were enough fish on the spawning grounds, and then they'd, you know, close the weir, harvest some fish, and then let some more through. There's a lot of similarities between the way indigenous people used to manage their weirs and their fisheries and what we currently do, actually.
Who is currently operating weirs on the Kuskokwim?
Weirs are currently operated by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on the Tuluksak and Kuiplek, and then by Alaska Department of Fish and Game on the George and the Kerguelec. And then the Paiute operates the weir on the Salmon River up here on the Aniak and Pentienti up in Grather. They operate the Salmon River, the weir on the Salmon River up there off the Pickup Fork.
I think that the volunteers and workers that work the weirs, the crews that are hired through the local villages, those are excellent segues into fish biology, fish and game jobs. Am I correct in making that assumption?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Off the top of my head, I would say about 95% of the crews that we hire to man the weirs are local hires. And they do. They provide a great opportunity, introductory opportunity for people to get involved in resources, resource management. And we've had several technicians go on to get, you know, college degrees. Some of them are now in advanced programs, getting masters. Hopefully they'll get their PhDs. And we also typically use the weirs as platforms for our outreach and education, youth outreach and education opportunities. We used to do that with K&A through our high school internship program, and then we're currently doing it on the George River through our George River internship program, where we take students up there and they see how weir operates. We talk to them about the data that's collected, how that's used in management, and things like that.
Well, I'm going to shift gears just a second here and come back here into the studio. I hope you'll stay with us on the line. I hope it's not taking too much of your time. But I want to ask Mary. Mary, I know there's a fish opener coming up tomorrow. I also know you have your weekly teleconference coming up today. So I'm going to let you take the wheel.
Okay, that's true. We do have a subsistence opening tomorrow. It is from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m., and people are allowed to use 6-inch mesh, 45 meshes deep. It can be 6-inch mesh or smaller. 50 fathoms below Johnson River, that's a full shackle, or a half a shackle, or 25 fathoms, or 150 feet above the mouth of the Johnson River. All your buoys must be marked if you're using a set net. It can either be set net or drift. And there's, besides the opening tomorrow from 10 to 10, there's also one with the same gear type on Saturday from 10 to 10.
That's great. So if you can't get the day off tomorrow to take advantage of that opener and you have Saturday off, you will be able to do it between the same time, 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Saturday as well.
That's right. And one of the things managers looked at was the tide coming in to make sure that people can fish the incoming tide. Down here, you know, Kuiplek and below, we have, it's a tidal estuary, so tides come in and out, and everybody knows that fish come in on the incoming tide, so you want to make sure you're fishing on the incoming tide.
All right, I got two things I want to touch base on before we're really short on time. The weekly teleconference, how's that gone, and do we get a lot of callers calling in?
We have a lot of people listening in, and there are a fair amount of questions and back and forth, and it's been really good.
We're talking
good
about so the Kuskokwim River Intertribal Fish Commission's weekly teleconference that takes place on Mondays, 10 a.m. to noon. You can call in 1-800-315-6338 and use access code 34514 to join the conversation. And the last thing I want to talk about, we talked about it before we went on, that's the age, size, the scale thing. That kiddos could do this as a job.
Anybody can do it, yeah.
Tell them what we're
talking
about.
So ONC provides sampling kits. And if you are catching kings, or if you know people that are catching kings, you go and you ask the fisherman, if you can take three scales off of that fish and you put that on the card, and then you do a small amount of other measurements, how long it is, and then whether it's a female or a male. And then you get $5 per fish.
$5 per fish?
Yeah, and there's 10 fish per card, so $50 a card.
This beats mowing lawns. This beats shoveling sidewalks. This is what everyone should be doing besides playing Nintendo. They should be down there harassing fishermen coming off the water.
That's right.
Harassing is a bad word to use. But kids, if you're listening, or parents, if you're listening, get your kids involved in the fish count. Contact ONC. Yeah. Get a kit and start making some money.
Well, or if you have a fish camp, somebody at your fish camp could definitely be taking these samples. They used to be done off of commercial caught fish, but since we don't have that anymore, it's really important that we get subsistence fish data.
This is spectacular stuff. Dan will join us tomorrow. We'll be talking a little bit more about the weirs and fish wheels and the counts, and we'll also probably get an update from Mary, perhaps calling in, or we'll just get an update about the conference from today, what went on.
Sure.
And we'll be have more subsistence conversations all throughout the season. Let me give Dan a chance to get any last words in. Dan?
Thanks, Grady. Just real quick, the reason I did this show is because I've noticed there's a lot of concerns about weirs and their harm to fish. And you asked that question originally. I don't think I really answered it. Let me try to answer it through a quick question to you. In which way are beaver dams and weirs most alike? A, they impound or hold water. B, they provide rearing habitat for fish. Or C, they sometimes block fish passage upstream.
Ooh, I would say B. I think that they probably provide some place for the smallest.
That's my answer as well.
Nope. Actually, it would be C. Both beaver dams and weirs, they do at times block fish passage. Like I mentioned before, the weirs, you can close the weir, and so fish hold behind it for a period of time, and then they open the weir and the fish pass. And in many ways, that's kind of similar to how beaver dams behave out on the land.
Dan, that's about all the time we have, because we're going to get cut off by the next thing on the thing. You don't forget to be awesome to everyone in your earshot. This was Coffee at KYUK. Thank you for joining us, everyone. Dan, have an excellent day. Mary, thank you for coming in.
Each weekday, a member of the community is invited to Coffee at KYUK to discuss news and information relevant to Bethel and the Kuskokwim Delta. Sometimes light, sometimes serious, Coffee at KYUK is where our community connects.
Well, it's another great day in the Delta. Today's June 12th. I'm dating the show. I'm sitting here on the other side of the control board. I'm not quite used to this, Petra. Petra's sitting there at the place she normally sits during the show, but normally I'm in the booth there with a guest. Today, both of our guests are on the phone. I believe that we have Dan and Dan. We have the Dan Show. Dan Gillikin and Dan Esai are both on the phone. Hello, Dans. Good morning.
Good morning, Brady.
I'll give it to Dan Esai first for a subsistence report and some anecdotes about some activities out on the river. Is that right, Dan?
Yes. So the salmon are at just pulled into Blackwater on June 10th, the night of June 10th or something like that. They might have been in there for a while. They got a... They're keeping the small jack salmons, and then last night I heard that they got about eight, but the communication was spotty, so they probably only kept the last little jack salmons and let the other big ones go. And they were letting the big males and big females go, I guess. They're using a state permit system for 10 per household or 2 per household, and they're using 4-inch mesh. The river... The water is rising. I flew over to the Alaska Range yesterday, and there's still a lot of snow up there. It's still melting, and the river's getting high already. And there's a lot of trash floating down the river, so some set net sites we're not using. And all the cotton leaves and stuff are falling. The bluebells are out, and those hips are out, so... traditionally the upriver people always say the salmon are out. And the Salmon River fish weir is in, I guess, right now as we speak.
Well, and, I'm glad you mentioned the fish weirs, Dan, because we've been sitting and talking about weirs yesterday and today, and we have Dan Gillikin, the environmental director from the native village of Napaimute, talking specifically about that. Dan, are you familiar with that weir?
Yes. The numbers are increasing every year since they put it in. Last year it was 7,000 plus salmon, king salmon that passed. And then out of that 7,000, the local fishermen that had the underneath, below the fish weir, the only salmon they kept was probably between, they said not that much, only 50 to 80.
Mr. Gillikin, that's one weir of how many in total on the Delta region?
Yeah, like I mentioned yesterday, Grady, we're going to have six weirs in operation this year on the Kuskokwim total.
Dan Gillikin, how are they operated? Do they count every fish?
Well, as a quick refresher, you know, I mentioned yesterday that weirs, you have to think about weirs as if they're like picket fences, right? And so they have gaps in between them. And what those fences do is they funnel fish through an opening in that fence and into a trap. And so what folks do, and the way we count fish, is we open the gate on that trap and somebody sits on top of the trap over looking down, and they actually count the fish as they pass through the opening in that fence. Now, when they're not sampling, then they close that trap and they let fish kind of build up behind the weir for a period of time. But they don't count every single fish that passes through the weir. For certain types of weirs, there are a couple of weirs on the Quipuc and the Tumatec that Fish and Wildlife Office. Those are video weirs, and they actually do try to count every fish. It's a video equipment that's actually installed at that trap, and they can record every fish that passes through. Then they go back through, and they identify each of those fish by species.
How does that?
Go ahead.
Oh, how does that differ from the weirs that are operated by crews? And do the crews don't count fish all the time, though, right? When they're crew monitored.
What they do is they sample on a schedule. So they basically sample for 4 hours on and then 4 hours off. Now that gets adjusted depending on the number of fish that are passing through the weir or if they have to collect biological data off the fish, but they're required to sample at a minimum 16 hours a day. So there are periods of time when nobody's sitting on the weir. And like I mentioned before, that you know they'll close the weir at that period when they're not counting fish. And then what happens is sometimes people come up on the weirs and they don't see anybody sitting out there, and they see fish maybe stacking up behind the weir, and they think that it's blocking their passage upstream. But that's usually just a temporary situation. And then they go sample, and the fish pass through the weir, and they count as many as they can. Sometimes the weirs blow out. We get holes in them, or they get completely blown out by high water, or we have to leave the site for some reason for a long period of time. And what we'll do is we'll just open the weir or try to estimate how long maybe there was a gap. You know, the weir wasn't fish site, we call it. And then you'll estimate the fish that could have passed during that time period. So
I'm curious, you know, how does this information impact subsistence users? How is it packaged for them? You know, give me that that view. How does this information affect subsistence users?
Well, the information is actually presented at the working group meetings in season to give us an idea of the kind of escapement that we're experiencing that year. And that plays very strongly into the management decisions and the working group's decisions to allow more fishing opportunity or less fishing opportunity. I really believe that, you know, fisheries managers and subsistence users and the advisory groups, you know, they share a common objective here. They want to provide as much fishing opportunity for folks on the river without jeopardizing long-term sustainability of the stocks. Because without the resource, there is no subsistence. The way we try to, you know, make sure that we have long-term sustainability is we establish escapement goals. How many fish are we going to let onto the spawning grounds? How many seeds are we going to plant for the future, so to speak? So we have to meet those escapement goals if we want to have long-term sustainability of the stock. That's the whole idea behind it. So when we don't have enough fish to meet those escapement goals and provide for all of the harvest that has historically happened, then we have to put restrictions in place.
So what about those fish? Do weirs harm or kill fish?
Well, you know, I can't say 100% that weirs do not harm or kill some fish. There's certain environmental conditions, and certainly if the weir is not properly maintained or operated, it can harm fish. But we go to great lengths to train our crews, to communicate with our crews, to hire people that are responsible to take care of these weirs and take care of these fish. They do their very best. That being said, you know, the number of fish that are probably impacted is very, very small compared to the number of fish that are passing through. They do everything in their power to minimize that as much as possible. And you know, I can mention, too, that, you know, people kind of question that oftentimes. And I'll just mention that, you know, if that were the case, that weirs were actually harming fish significantly, then, you know, we've got weirs like the Kugluk that have been operating for over 40 years on the Kugluk. And if there was a, you know, significant impact as a result of that weir, then that stock would have been in trouble a long time ago. And actually, it's one of the stronger stocks that we have here on the Kuskokwim. And people have been operating weirs out here. You know, indigenous folks have been operating weirs out here on the Kuskokwim and throughout Alaska for centuries. And without harming those stocks, those returns, they were sustainable. Now, weirs got a really bad name around the turn of the century, about 1920 or so, when large commercial outfits moved into the southeast and they would essentially fence off entire streams and take the entire run of fish. And that led to the collapse of the fishery throughout Alaska. But that has been outlawed, and it's just not a very wise practice, really, if you want to have fish return to the future.
Yeah, it does seem to me imbalanced, and I'm ignorant to a lot of this, but it does seem imbalanced that we have a lot of controls and checks on subsistence use. What about those large fishers out in the Bering Strait and stuff? The dragnets and such. I don't want to get into that, but I know that that's an issue, and I'm confused a little bit. Maybe a brief comment there.
Well, you know, fisheries management is really difficult, and there's a lot of uncertainty. And anytime you're trying to manage a natural resource, the things that really impact it, there's never a silver bullet, right? It's always usually death of a thousand cuts, as they say. There's large impacts, there's moderate impacts, there's small impacts, and they all cumulatively can come together, you know, and have a large effect. Some of these things are completely out of our control. Things like the productivity of the Bering Sea, where Chinook salmon are spending most of their life actually growing to be adults. And we have, you know, just begun to understand how productivity of that is really affecting the returns to Chinook here in Western Alaska. I will say that, you know, there's, as far as the bycatch goes, there's plenty of information out there. People want to look up facts on it. I don't have the website handy, but I could provide it for you. And you can see the actual bycatch that's harvested. There's a great briefing paper on the ADF&G website about it. So it's certainly it has an impact, But is it the most significant impact at this time?
Cool. Would you, if you send us that those links, I'm sure that either Petra or I will get them into our show notes from today and yesterday's shows. You know, before we get out of time, I know that we had a, there was another point you wanted to make, that you had it in the form of a quiz, and Petra has hidden the quizzes from me. So,
okay, which, just one?
Well, you can, we'll do two of them.
Okay, well, let's start with, there was one I wanted to bring up, and, okay, when do salmon typically like to pass through the weir? When they feel like it, A, B, during high water, C, early in the morning and in the evening, or D, all of the above?
I'm going to say during high water.
Yeah, that's partially correct. Actually, it's all of the above. All of the above. The fish, you know, they don't, if you watch fish on the river or on a weir, there's certain times of the day that they don't want to move. High noon when the sun is directly on the river, during low water conditions, they don't like to move. And so that the crews try to schedule their sampling periods when the fish don't really want to move anyway, so that they're not impeding their passage. So all of the above, and the crews take those things into consideration when they're sampling.
All right, so we have time for one more, but we won't have as much time for the explanation. Go ahead.
Okay, final quiz. So I have three items. And I'd like you to list them in the highest priority first, all right? Provide harvest opportunity for commercial and sport fishing, meet established escapement goals, or provide for subsistence harvest opportunity.
I'm going to have to say B, meet established escapement goals. The second one, provide for subsistence harvest opportunity. Three, provide harvest opportunity for the commercial sport fishery.
You win. You, winner, winner, chicken dinner. That's exactly correct, Petra.
Well, I'm going to remember that.
Yeah, we have to meet escapement goals first. That's true of both state and federal requirements. And then provide for subsistence opportunity, if there is enough fish to do that, and then provide for commercial and sport fishery.
Can I add on?
Oh, we have about 25 seconds. Go ahead.
Hey, before there was commercial openings in Bethel in the lower river, they used to have fish traps and fish fence up in, on the Salmon River Pitka Fork. The fish were so huge and so big that they would almost tear down the fish fence. They would get all they need, and then they'd open the fish fence so the salmon could go through, and the rivers used to get high. That was the last time they had fish trap in was 1966 or 67, I think.
All right. Well, I'm sorry. That's all the time we have to get to. I wanted to tell people about tomorrow's guest and what's coming up next on Native American Calling, but I'll have to scratch that because it's only time enough to tell you to be awesome to each other. You've been on Coffee at KYUK. Thank you for joining us, Dan.
Thanks.